right, welcome to another edition of Renegade Radio. Glad to have you guys with us today. We're going to talk more exciting topics about companies that are breaking the rules of conventional thinking, doing things unique and different. Hopefully you guys have your notepads ready and you're going to learn some great stuff today about how you can take yourself and your business to another level by getting out of those conventional thought processes. Joined with a great panel today, we've got Michael Kogan from Definition 6, who's going to talk to us a little bit about relationship economics and how to build a brand through relationship. We got Dan Homrick. He's coming from SmartSoft Mobile Solutions because we're talking about the future of mobility, which is hugely important to us in today's business world. And then, of course, we got Jim Beach, and he is the author of a new book called School for Startups. And Jim, if it's all right, I'm going to start with you today because when it comes to breaking the rules of conventional thinking, I think we get out of the gate pretty quick with your topic, because you say right out of the beginning that entrepreneurship, it's not about creativity, it's not about risk, and it's not about passion, which are some of the things that typically are associated with being an entrepreneur. So, A, welcome to the show, Jim, and B, tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Andy. It's nice to be here. I appreciate it. We started thinking about this topic several years ago. Chris Hanks and I, we were both professors with a small p down at Georgia State University teaching entrepreneurship, and we came to realize that we were not risk takers, both of us, and we were not really creative people, but both of us were very successful entrepreneurs. And the more we thought about it, the more we realized, you know what? That's the essence of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurs are not risk-taking people. That's the word on the street. If you play Family Feud, top 100 answers define entrepreneurship, I think the top three answers would be risk takers, passionate people, and creative. And we realize that when you eliminate those three, Andy, it's possible for anyone to become an entrepreneur.
Okay, well, let's start with one of those topics. Let's start with risk. People say that business is risky. And, of course, this is a mindset that keeps a lot of people, as you say, out of the entrepreneurship world, out of the business world. So why is it not risky? Why, in your mind, is it not a risk to take on a small business?
Well, you're exactly right. The myth is, I've got two kids about to go off to college. I can't take that risk right now. Or a lot of other risk-based excuses. And we've learned that if you start off and have one simple rule, I am only going to start this business with $5,000 and not a cent more, that you eliminate the risk. Most of us have jobs still, thank God, and we take a summer vacation. We probably blow $5,000 to go to Atlantis or Disney or whatever. Next summer, you're not going to go. You're going to take that $5,000 and start a business on the side. And the responses I hear are, typically, well, I can't start my business with $5,000. Well, first, I'd like you to rethink that. In the book, we have incredible businesses that were started for under $5,000, including a 15-unit restaurant chain, a restaurant bar chain. Alabama's largest independent beer company was started for under $5,000. I can go on and on. The examples are out there. 450 of the Fortune 500 were started with under $5,000 historically. If you eliminate the idea that I'm going to start with $100,000, you can start a lot of cool businesses. So don't make the idea that you don't have money a burden. Number two about risk, though, maybe you shouldn't be starting a business as your first business that needs $100,000, like a cell phone company or something. Maybe you should scale back your ambitions, and that's unfortunately part of the realism of risk reduction.
Okay, well, let's go here, because I get the idea, hey, don't start the $100,000. Don't try to go out and buy a McDonald's franchise right out of the gate because you just don't have the capital. Okay, so what most people do by default, if they don't have the capital to go out, is they say, okay, well, what do I enjoy doing? What am I passionate about? What would be fun, and can I make money at that? And then they go into a venture that's based on passion or something they have an interest in. You say not necessarily.
Well, can I interject something? As you were halfway through that question, I thought of something else. One of the things they do is they say, I'm just going to wait right now because I don't have the money, or I'll go try to find $100,000. I'll go, raise money or go get a loan or angel or something. And I've met a lot of people who have spent 2 or 3 years raising money or 2 or 3 years writing a business plan instead of just going out there and trying to sell something. And so we'll come back to that in a minute. But don't you know, use this excuse of, well, I don't have the money, so I'm going to go do it, raise the money. Again, that's an excuse for inertia. Your question about passion, though, I'm really passionate about two or three things. One of them is woodworking. I'd love to make furniture for a living, but it really is bad. I made a chair the other day, sat on it, broke. And so I'm not good at it. I can't make a living doing that. And I've had to realize that, you know what, that's reserved for the weekends. I can make a living doing other things, and I'm passionate not about those things that I sell, because I don't think it's really normal to be passionate about a thing, like a product, but I'm passionate about the fact that at 2 o'clock today, my daughter has soccer practice, and I'm going to watch, and there's no one who can stop me. I'm passionate about the fact that I control my own destiny. I'm passionate about the fact that I make as much money as I'm willing to work as hard to produce. You know, I'm passionate about the freedom, the luxury, the fact that I wear blue jeans and a t-shirt every single day. I'm not passionate about the process. I'm sorry, I'm passionate about the process, not the product. I'm passionate about the fact, you know, that I can go to Disney what I want, and I think that's enough. So when we say you have to be passionate about what you do, I would challenge that and say, no, you can be passionate about the process. My life is really cool because I sell stuff that I don't really care about, but I'm passionate about the fact that I'm going to see a soccer practice at 2 o'clock today.
Just out of curiosity, are you a big Larry Wingate fan?
Sure. Yeah.
Reason I ask is he not long ago I saw an article from him, and it was right around this topic of passion. And he said, you know, he goes, it's not that I'm passionate about what I do. He goes, I'm good at what I do, and that's why I get paid for it. I'm passionate about spending time with my family and sitting on my back porch and grilling on my grill. So I just think it's right in line with what you're saying.
Mark Cuban had an article in Entrepreneur Magazine last week on the exact same thing. So they're all quoting me because my book came out first. So.
All right, very nice. So now in your book, you talk about the small business success in 90 days or less. Speed, again, being key. A lot of people think it takes a long time to get a business up and successful. Tell us about your thought on that.
All right, Andy, I want to give your listeners a business they can go start today for zero money, zero creativity, zero risk. Today at 2 o'clock, between lunch and dinner, when the restaurants are slow, go into a restaurant, not a big chain, but a mom and pop, or, you know, something that's got 3 or 4, 10 locations, like in Atlanta area, like Ippolito's or someplace like that, and go in and say, hey, Mr. Manager, you don't have a very good social media, and of course have to check this out before. You're not collecting Twitter addresses. I could eat here and you would never know my email address. I could eat here 100 times and you would never know my email address. For $250 a month, I would like to be the social media manager for this restaurant, and I will collect Twitter addresses. I will build a fan base. On a slow Tuesday night, 2 or 3 months from now, you call me up. I will send out social media and fill up your restaurant on a slow Tuesday night. For $250 a month, I would like to drive revenue for you using social media. I think if you went into 10 restaurants, how many do you think you could sell with that pitch? I think you're going to sell 2 or 3.
At least, yeah.
And all of a sudden, you're an entrepreneur with a social media marketing business with a restaurant niche. And an 18-year-old could go do that, and they would probably love to do it because they're passionate about that horrible Facebook thing. And a 58-year-old who's unemployed could go start that business today too. Absolutely no risk, no creativity, and the 58-year-old doesn't have to be passionate about restaurants or social media or Facebook. They could be passionate about the fact that they have a paycheck.
Okay, now let's address the paycheck side here, because I think this is a new way of thinking that I'm hearing from emerging entrepreneurs. A lot of people want the million-dollar idea. They want to come up with the thing that's going to make them rich very quickly, and it's a single business, and they're going to pour all their time, effort, and energy into it. But yet, we see a lot of entrepreneurs that are taking an approach similar to the one you talked about, where, in your example, if we found 2 or 3 restaurants that would buy into this, we're producing $750 a month worth of revenue. But that's not taking a full month worth of working time. I've got a lot of time that I could pursue another business or 3 or 4. So in your strategy, do you talk about that, keeping your options open until you see which idea really has legs?
Yeah, exactly. You know, in that situation, if you got 2 or 3 restaurants, my advice would be to go to get, you know, 20 or 30 restaurants and scale that business and then hire people to do the work for you. And, you know, that would be my advice there. But I do love the multiple income stream idea. We are very much, again, we are risk adverse. So if you have a job, you keep it and you do this on the side. You know, Andy, the one of the big things that people think is that $5,000 a year is not sexy of extra income. Well, that's called a couple car payments at my house, you know, and that's cool to me. So if in the first year and I have a job, say I have a, you know, a job working at Exit 9 and I'm making $60,000 a year and I go home and watch The Real Housewives and then I switch over to Sports Center and, you know, get the kids to bed and stuff. Why don't you stop doing all of that? Start your new business at 6 o'clock and work until midnight, work all weekend, every weekend. You take up smoking so that at 2 o'clock you can go out and have a smoke break when you're really calling someone that you need to get on the phone with. And you do that on the side to keep your risk low. You still got your health insurance, you still got your benefits, still getting the mortgage covered, and hopefully your business will do $5,000 on the side the first year, do 10 or 20 the second year, the third year it'll do 50, and what we pray for is that in the fourth year you get fired because your boss has finally figured out what you're doing.
Now, you said something earlier I want to come back to because I think it's really at the heart of being a business person, and people get such a convoluted mindset really around sales. And you said, don't spend a year or two going out trying to collect all this money. Just go sell something.
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in that. The number one place that you're going to learn about your product is in the marketplace, going out and seeing what 10 buyers say about it. Your pitch will change. It goes, you know, it will morph, go from mediocre to great, hopefully. You'll learn what the marketplace is looking for. I think that, you know, all of this writing of a business plan is a big waste of time. I like the research, but I don't like the writing. You know, I fill my head with the research and then go in the marketplace and see what the market tells you about your product. If I can't sell it, then I change my pitch for number two. And I think that is better time spent than either writing a business plan or going out and trying to get funding to do that business. I spent 3.5 years raising angel. I did 2.6 of angel, and then I did a VC round of somewhere in the eights back in the 90s, and that consumed 100% of my time. You know, I was the CEO of the business, but I wasn't running the business. I was raising money. I think it's a waste of time. Just go sell stuff. Go see what the market says about your product.
All right. Well, very good. I think there's a ton more questions that we can explore, and I definitely want to get a few more things on the table before we wrap up today. But I don't want to leave Dan just sitting over here. Can I bring him into the conversation and then come back?
I can't wait to see what he's going to tell us about mobile. I need to know that.
All right. Well, fantastic. So Dan Homrick is with SmartSoft Mobile Solutions. Dan, you're the CEO of that company, and you're here today to tell us really about the future of business when it comes to the mobile platform. So welcome to the show.
Well, great. Thanks for having me here, Andy.
Tell us a little bit about SmartSoft. What do you guys do, and what are you really preaching to the market about mobile technology?
It's simply stated, the world's gone mobile, and while that may seem obvious, it hasn't necessarily sunk into everybody's head about what that means. What we do when we speak to business people to help them understand where we're moving, we talk about driving additional return on investment out of their existing systems. So that's something they can typically grasp, right, because they want to look at ROI and help understand that. When we speak with innovative people or people who, quote-unquote, get it, we help them understand they can reach their entire customer base or ecosystem through mobile devices, and that's the future of business.
So in technology, there are always various stages, right? They're the early adopters, people that are kind of front-running the technology, and then they're kind of the masses come in, and then they're the late adopters that really follow the back end, and they're the stragglers, if they were. Mm-hmm. Where are we in the mobile technology cycle right now?
It's best segmented by two different approaches. One would be looking at a business-to-business environment, and the other is business-to-consumer. So we've seen a lot of activity by leaders such as the Home Depot, who have a tremendous mobile application. They're interacting with their customers. There's a number of companies like that out there that are really driving a connection between their business and their ultimate customers. So those companies by far are leading the revolution. And I'm segmenting the whole game genre, right? So Angry Birds, I mean, that clearly is a mobile solution and phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But businesses are first leading the way are organizations large and small in the business-to-consumer arena. And the important note here is that small businesses, just to talk about what Jim said, you know, being able to deliver a presence for a customer on a mobile device changes the landscape dramatically for businesses who want to reach customers, right? It's a very cost-effective way to do this on mobile devices now. The second element is on the business-to-business. So we see early customers of ours that are delivering solutions on consumer-grade mobile devices to their ecosystem and reaching thousands and thousands of new customers they never had before.
And are they doing this through social media? Are they, do they have applications? Are they doing it through some type of text marketing? I mean, what are they really doing to drive those B2B relationships?
Yes, yes, and yes. Right?
Okay.
So actually, you got the trifecta there, and it is an important element of it. The Facebook comment earlier, Jim, we sort of recognize it as something that has to be tended to. But when you're building your brand, what we recommend our larger customers is incorporate that Facebook, that Twitter environment into your application so the customer is always going to your app. The market segmentation right now and the adoption of devices, things like that, in the United States, it will be predominantly smartphones, period, end of story, across all socioeconomic barriers or lines or segments. In other markets, texting, it's important still here in the U.S., but in other markets, particularly overseas and still developing countries, it's very important.
It's picking up a lot of steam here, though, too, isn't it? We were just talking yesterday. We had some social media people in the studio, and I made the comment, in my experience, people don't respond as quickly or even as often to phone calls or email anymore, but yet I can text someone and get a pretty quick hit back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's why traditionally those have been segmented. They're really one mobile experience. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you think about it that way, you may target your end user by the capabilities. So if I'm looking for someone who has feature phones as opposed to smartphone because they're part of my buying demographic, maybe I need to do something there. But the reality is the smartphones replacing PCs or the tablets replacing PCs. So having unified communications into those areas is important. But that all sounds real complicated, right? And sophisticated. The reality is it's being able to converse intimately with your end customer.
Okay. Now we're talking mobile, but really you mentioned there's kind of three prongs to the future of software technology. It's not just mobile, but it's cloud and big data. Mm-hmm. So maybe tell us about the other two areas with cloud and big data and how they play into this mobile realm.
Okay. So one of the things that when we started this company, speaking of entrepreneurship, you know, we started this company 4 years ago. What we recognized was there will be a displacement in what we would consider business software. So organizations will no longer have to go out necessarily and evaluate big back office systems, right? They're going to go to the cloud and say, I want my Salesforce.com or I want my SAP system or my Oracle or my Microsoft in the cloud serving up all the information I need, and I want it all done on the mobile. Okay, so that's a real game changer. That means a small company now can have the same access to the same capabilities that the largest Fortune 100 companies have access to, all right? So that's one. The second element of that is big data is the assimilation of all the information, but more importantly, what mobility allows one to do is make decisions real-time based upon information that's in the cloud. So whether it's using things like location-based services or business intelligence or driving data details, when I sit down and talk with Andy, I know all about Andy, and I'm going to drive information specifically to him.
So when we think about mobile and mobile technology, we hear a lot about the external, you know, what it's going to do for your business external. But can you touch on maybe internal? What is the potential of mobile and cloud computing to really expand and increase the productivity of the internal culture of an organization?
Oh, that's great. And thinking that this audience may be typically larger than Fortune 100 companies, right? Knowing there's a smattering of all of them. The cloud allows an organization to test out software solutions in their business, right, for very cost effective. So we have solutions, for example, that allow someone to do something as simple as a purchase order approval, and that's about the most unsexy element of business or business processes. But what it allows organizations to do is streamline compliance, right, streamline the availability of the CEO to see all the expenses that are moving through the system. We have large corporations that do this as well. So very simple business functions that can be accomplished on a mobile device. You never have to go to a desktop. You don't have to worry about anything but having access via your cell phone. And then the big data element of that just corresponds to that in making sure that you're leveraging the knowledge, call it crowdsourcing, call it any number of different things that you want, but all the information that's available out there in the internet or available in the cloud that you can leverage inside your business. One of the most important elements of this, and it's a different level of thinking, organizations have historically been very protective of all of their data, right? And there's a good reason for being so. However, at the same time, sharing of that data can help them become more efficient. So if I want to open up my information to my supply chain, right, let's say I've got a manufacturing process and I want someone to understand when my inventory is being depleted, well, why not give them access to my information in my back office real time on a cell phone or mobile device, right, so that they can respond immediately and quickly rather than having to go back, print something out, or make a phone call. So it's obvious, but not everyone's employing it.
Well, let's talk about that. Why not? I mean, it does make sense. It does seem obvious. Why aren't companies moving forward on it?
That's a great question, and the answer to that is a little bit of legacy. So the traditional world of mobility has always been, I'm going to download a bunch of data to a device, and I'm going to go drive around in a truck and do things with this data, right? That data has to be very secure. I've got a lot of concern about costly to get involved with. So a device that may cost a couple thousand dollars, and I had to have private networks. Well, the field has been leveled, right? So I've got 3G or 4G, basically cell phone coverage. I got a device that's $199, and then I sign up for 24 months. Now I just need access to the back office system. Most of the historical mobile devices have always had that download of data, and then hence security was a big concern. Now, we're not saying security is not a concern, but what we do recognize is the fact that if I don't store data on the device, but I give access to the back office system, that really mitigates the risk tremendously. And more companies are adopting that kind of approach. So they're bringing in their own devices. They're allowing access by not storing data, but they have access to the information in the back office, not storing data on the device, and making the applications very, very simple to use. And that's what's driving the adoption nowadays.
Okay, got it. Well, I want to dig a little deeper in this because I also want to tie you back into Jim. I want to find out how entrepreneurs should be using this mobile mm-hmm. technology as well. But before I do, I want to breach into this next topic of more relationship economics and really what people should be doing with their brand and how to leverage this mobile technology to reach customers and build relationships. So I want to go to Michael Kogan. Michael is the CEO from Definition 6. And Michael, welcome to the show. And tell us a little bit about Definition 6 and this idea of how do we build this ongoing interactive relationship with our customers.
So we have about 6 weeks to work on that answer.
if we need that time, everybody get some water, get some snacks. Michael's going to be a little while.
So, I mean, right now we've got a situation where consumers are not only demanding what they want to know about a company, they're demanding where and when they want to know it, and do you give them video, do you give them audio, do you give them a gaming experience? And there's so many things going on in sort of the new demand from the consumer that businesses are, to a certain degree, it's worse than the Wild West. At least you knew you were headed west. I mean, at this point, it's quite an interesting environment. You can take any experience you have right now, put it back 15 years ago, and what you can do now while literally on a skateboard while you're a 16-year-old kid, you couldn't do 15 years ago in a data center at NASA. So it's really an interesting moment in time to think about how do consumers and businesses dance together suddenly. Who's lead and who's following, and how do you change that cadence when it's appropriate. So that's kind of what's a very high level how to think about that.
Well, you kind of lay out some of the steps that someone needs to be thinking about. Maybe you can take us through a few of those. I mean, sure. You kind of begin with find and define.
Sure.
So maybe let's start there and just take us through the process of what we should be looking at as far as this relationship with our customers.
Yeah, okay. So to kind of clinically dissect it, you can think of it in a multiple stage step, but certainly this notion of defining who your audience is. When I was talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about what good is TV anymore. And I said TV advertising is a perfect medium when you don't exactly know who your audience is yet. You suspect that they are of a certain demographic, a certain socioeconomic class, but you really don't know who they are yet. So you throw it out on TV, and you're trying to find and seek out your audience. And then you move them from that, and maybe you've directed them to a hashtag campaign or a website address or a mobile app to download, and they've self-declared, I am your audience. You've now found me. And you can start to put definitions around what they're going to want to do at each step in the relationship cadence. Once you go from there, you have to make sure you're doing something in a way that engages them to take action. Literally on the plane this week, I read an article that says millennials, people who are under, let's say, 28 years old, shift media 13 to 27 times per hour. Mm. So think about that. They're between texting, talking, watching video on TV, on their third screen device, whatever, 13 to 27 times in an hour, you're switching through that. So you better do an engagement phase within this. How do I create this engaging experience to where I can convert them from interest tire kickers to a acquired customer? After that, the world of big data opens up to you because you can now measure and monitor almost every single action. You have to do it in appropriate ways. But at a net level, you can know when people change from, like, let's say, using a mobile app to look up a hotel room, but a mobile website to transact the booking, to a phone call to confirm some special request detail. You can track that customer across all those mediums. So the world of big data opens up and allows you to get into the last stage, which is personalization that causes amplification. If you can personalize the experience, they will then amplify it at no cost to you. The positive experience. There's also the downside corollary that they will amplify negative experiences. But in most times, social media activation and conversation marketing that users generate, other than the most extreme cases, it's normally a positive sentiment if you give them a good experience. So those are kind of a way to clinically walk through it.
So what are some key points? If I've got social media and I have a fan page, for example, and we see companies that have, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers, as it were, but yet there's no real engagement. What are some things they should be doing to engage those customers and get them to take action that will actually lead to spending dollars?
Participatory storytelling. People want to be part of the story. I don't know if who remembers reading books when you were young where you got to choose, does Bob take a left and follow the villain up the hill, or does he take a right and chase him through the, using a sailboat. But whatever it was, those stories where you got to make some choices and the outcome was different based on what you chose, those were really engaging books. If brands today can create participatory storytelling with their consumer, where you start the story, you ask them to add to it, then you ask somebody else to add to it, then you add a little bit, and you put those type of thinking patterns into your entire experience with your consumer, you get much higher level of engagement and purchase, not just purchase intent, but actual purchase. And then again, you create some brand fans. So that's one of the really key things that everybody has to start getting good at is a story that allows your user, your consumer, to participate with you.
Can you share maybe a company that you have gone through that process with that we could go and we could look at their page and we could kind of see how they're engaging this technology?
Sure, I'll do one that's not a customer of mine so that I don't have to disclaim and say there's bias. I'll use Uncle Ben's
Fair
rice.
Enough.
And I got exposed to Uncle Ben's rice cooking recipe submission because what they did is they put together a program where kids with their families would put together a rice-based recipe. And then you would put it out on their Facebook community and you get people to vote for which recipe you liked the best. Well, it was designed with a payoff was like a $50,000 remodel for your elementary school's cafeteria. So there was a lot of sort of community engagement, particularly in the private charter school systems where the parents are very involved in making sure that there's, you know, good facilities. Also, you have a lot of very highly engaged magnet schools and, you know, urban developed schools where the PTAs are very involved in improving the physical plant. So Uncle Ben's did this great program, and what it did is the story was get together with your family and tell us about a family tradition of a rice meal. So you have all these videos of grandkids with their grandmothers, largely, doing an old family recipe and hearing about, oh, we used to do this when I was your age, and it's this 80-year-old woman talking to her 6-year-old daughter. And then it starts getting shared and voted on, and, you know, it really, you know, it was a very great program. And I can tell you, in my house, in every house that I knew at the school from going to different dinner things, we started to joke, I think I'm done with rice for a little while. Every kid wanted a rice recipe at home because they were so excited about it. So suddenly you got this really good engagement with your consumer where it mattered, and you started the story with this, tell us your favorite recipe, and you let the consumers put their own spin on it. And frankly, the ones that seem to have done the best are the ones that have this interplay across generations. And so I think it's a really good example, and it worked on mobile very well. It worked on Facebook very well. And then there's going to be a payday, and then they're going to get another cycle of the winners and all the successes there. And if they're really smart, they'll take pictures of construction, and the kids will get to talk about what it was like to watch something be built, and then they can really add legs to it. So I'm hoping that they'll do that. If you're listening out there, call me if you weren't planning on doing that.
Well, let's talk about that, because some of our listeners are smaller businesses. They're not the size of Uncle Ben's, sure. And they don't have $50,000 to put towards a program. What would you say to them? What type of program could they put together to do that same type of engagement, but just obviously on a smaller budget?
Sure. Smoothie King, so an individual franchisee or somebody who runs their own individual sort of health food store. Let's have my most heroic moment powered by whatever their power drink is, and you let the live-walk community around this little small mystical business that I'm making up talk about the best cross-training workout that you could complete now that I've been using your whey protein infuser into my power meal. And then, you know, let that be put up on the Facebook community and let everybody say, oh, that's nothing, I did this. And, you know, you kind of get that kind of, how am I using the product to make what's important to my lifestyle choice work? And that will cost you nothing. And, you know, give them whatever, you know, every 10 times they come in, you're giving them a power, a free smoothie anyway. Make it every 100 shares that their story gets, you give them one. I mean, so that kind of thing is just real easy off the top of the head thing, a smaller business could do. And you could do that for auto or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people do love the story. I'm a triathlete myself, mm-hmm. and the Ironman logo, which is part of the World Triathlon Corporation, they are very, very keen on this. You know, the whole Kona-inspired, it's inspirational. What's your Ironman story? And yep. They're very good at collecting those interviews and those films and really using that to build the brand. And there has been huge success in promoting that brand. So it's right along the lines of what you're talking about, and it's not costing them a ton of money to do that either.
I mean, 2 years ago, Time Magazine had the person of the year was you. And it sort of, we've all been the movie star or hero of our own narrative in our minds all of our lives. Now, all of a sudden, you have a tool to share that, so it's a pretty easy user behavior, human behavior to harness, and it's what you see with a lot. You can look at Doritos when they did the user-generated ad campaigns for the Super Bowl ad spots that they've done. I mean, if you think about a lot of the viral successes, I mean, even the Old Spice campaign, not the first one, but the extension one where you tweeted in and got, you know, real-time responses, people did it because they wanted to have a 15-second video snippet of that. So it's easy to tap into once you think about, why would a consumer love my business? Do it this way. Why do you love your business? Why did you decide to do it? What is the story that you're telling? Those are your best customers. There's that alignment. What kind of story would you want to engage in? And then twist it and make it theirs.
Got it. Well, let's do this. Let's open the mics up and let's bring everybody back in. I want to come back to Jim really right out of the gate here, because we've heard a lot of things about how to build a business and how to build a brand and how to use mobility. And, of course, with some of the fly-in-the-face ideas that you have, Jim, I'd just like to hear your perspective on taking some of these technologies, some of these services, which ones are important, which ones are immediate, and how do you leverage them to an entrepreneur?
Well, again, you know, I imagine that the services that both of these guys are offering are a lot out of my $5,000 price range, right? But, you know, as Michael was describing those campaigns, a lot of those, and your question implied a large cost. I think a lot of those campaigns can be run by one person at home, and that would be what the entrepreneur would be spending their time on. You know, they would be spending 3 hours a day on marketing. That 3 hours a day would be on Facebook stuff. I think I could set up a campaign on Facebook for my business. I don't think it requires great, great skill. Obviously, Michael would do it better than I would do it dramatically. But, you know, our goal would be different. His customers want 1 million hits. You know, I'd be satisfied with 1,000 or something like that. So I would still say the strategies are the same. I would, you know, what they are saying is best practices. And it's best practice for General Electric and Joe's Body Shop and everyone in between.
Jim, I'd like to add some context and some thinking to that. I hate to use the word, I think you're wrong on one of those things, but actually I think the small business guy is better suited because it's about authenticity, it's about direct connection, it's about being very real. And frankly, the large corporations don't exist as that authentic person. They work very hard to create their brand persona to be humanized. But the human that runs the small business actually is in the best position to do it. So, you know, so just a little spin on it, you know, guys, when you're starting your business, women, when you're starting your business, you know why you did it. Just share it on all these social channels, and it works in a very authentic way. So I'd say don't be disheartened by the notion that Doritos does it. Be heartened by the fact that people care more about you than they do the board of directors of Doritos.
Yeah, now here's the budget switch. Let's talk about that because, you know, Jim talks about, hey, you want to get your business off the ground for $5,000. Well, getting it off the ground at $5,000, you do have to be careful where you put your money, and you should be doing some of this stuff on your own. But, Jim, as you mentioned about doing the angel investing, there comes a point where you got to kick this to someone else. Where's that break point? I mean, you know, maybe, Dan, you guys can speak to your wheelhouse. Who's a good customer? Who's that small business, and where are they at in their business that it's time to make that phone call?
Well, I'll start the conversation, but I'm going to go back to what these two gentlemen were just talking about to echo it. When we talk about mobility, it doesn't have to be us, and it doesn't have to be expensive, right? We work with some great brands. We also work with some very small companies, but both Jim and Michael pointed out that a Facebook page that I can access, right, on my smartphone gives me a presence that is unique to me everywhere, right? So the idea of mobility isn't come work with us. It's get mobile, right, because that's going to help you be sticky and intimate with your end customers. So just to clarify and to support what Jim has said earlier, that's the number of hours you invest in that Facebook page is the cost, okay? So it can be zero and then build from there. So companies come to us when he pointed out, he said, okay, we've got to go target this, right? For whatever reason, we find something. And usually, without getting too complex, they've identified someplace in their ecosystem where they see a unique business opportunity in today's market to leapfrog their competition, right? So that means that a home improvement store who had an app 2 years ago is 2 years ahead of the competition of someone who's delivering one today. Now, they have to deliver real value out of that, right? They just can't have the app, but they've got to move there. Another example is, give you a specific, just to help people have a use case they can put their minds around. We work with a local specialty insurance company that wanted to actually reduce the amount of fraud in their system, and they had a way that they needed an app, or they thought they needed the app to do this. Great company. Great solution, great product. The reality is that what they've done is they've created a unique solution in the market that separates them not because of fraud detection, but because they're servicing their customers better than anybody else out there that uniquely positioned. So it was a interesting byproduct, right, that is actually helping them be better positioned. So companies that have an entrepreneurial element, whether large or small, someone inside the company says, we've got to go do something. I'm not worried about the risk. I've just got to get something started mobile. They come to us. And then extremely large organizations that say that we need to have a campaign and a capability because mobility is going to be here for the next 30 years or longer, right? So it's a big answer to your question. But it's
one that matters. So same question, Michael. I mean, how do people know it's time to pick up the phone and call Definition 6?
Well, my my cocktail party answer always is when the CEO walked out of a board meeting and looked at you and said, you in marketing, you in IT, I just promised everybody we're going to get this done this year. And you look at each other and says, call Michael. But in a more of an entrepreneur's sense, more in a small business saying, I'm now going to start to look at my resources and where will I go from the startup where it's not just sweat equity, it's every hour, every minute of my day, and now I got to start to source other things. I would argue that you start to outsource those things that add the most value for what you're not going to be able to fund by spending the money on it. So, for example, if you suddenly are going to do online selling and you've decided, look, I've tried three different ways and now I'm past it, and I found out the website's going to be where my main channel is going to be, and you're really good at driving traffic because you've been tinkering with SEO, you've figured out social advertising, you've gotten good list management. So that's typically what you see as a startup can do. But then they need to really make the web presence work. That's sometimes that you need to bring in an expert because they have been working with how do you improve conversion over 40,000 transactions a minute for the last 16 years. And you're just getting to the point where you're starting to realize that if I could increase my conversion by 3%, I could 10x the size of my business. That's a good time to start to say, I'm going to not buy something else and put my money there. That's a framework I would use.
Well, guys, this show is all about breaking the rules of conventional thinking, really going against the grain and not being stupid, not doing things that don't make sense, but rather just looking at traditional mechanisms of doing business and looking at what doesn't work anymore, what's changed in the environment, and being that early adopter to make your business grow. What are some pieces of advice that maybe each of you have that you're either implementing with clients or maybe you're implementing inside of your own business that's really contrary to traditional norms of what we're all being told about business?
Boy, I'll start. it's for our particular business, getting back to very simple business process, because I think most people can relate to this. You don't have to go hit a home run. All you have to do in the case of mobility is get on first base. We take the most mundane business activities, such as approving a PO, and mobilize them, and there's huge benefit to that. So you don't have to go create the killer app. No, we never have. All right, we've got some great apps out there, but we've never created the killer app. What we've done is help businesses become more efficient by stepping into this. So you think about, if I could talk about, because it is mundane, but it's valuable, in the world of PO approval, CIO's happy, right, because they made the CFO happy because they're driving compliance. The CEO's happy because they're able to approve a PO when they're on an airplane and flying, hopefully, first class, right, overseas, and they get to drive compliance. Very simple application, relatively inexpensive to implement, not groundbreaking, right? But it's leveraging the new technology. And getting back to what Jim said, we usually find the people in the organizations that are trying to step out, sort of entrepreneurs inside an organization, to say, I need to solve a business problem. That's sometimes our best customers, right? So something simple, it doesn't have to be radical.
Yeah, well, your point's spot on there. I love the term, it doesn't have to be intellectually revolutionary. Mm-hmm.
Not at all. It's looking at something you've been doing over and over and over again that right now is paper-laden maybe or desktop-laden and just saying, what's a very cost-efficient way to do it? Everybody in the organization has a smartphone. So talk to them that way.
Makes a lot of sense. Michael, Jim?
I think being in the marketing world, coming out of a brand marketing background, coming out of, it's marketing and controlling the message, I'm going to say that I think the really successful new companies open up with a mindset that says, control was a myth, so I'm no longer going to fantasize that I can have it. So that they're much more fluid, they listen better, good ideas come from anywhere, and they accept that it's more like conducting the orchestra that can choose to step and grab another instrument at any time or walk into another room. So you need to help them make great music so that they'll stay working with you. And so I think you have to accept that control is It's more like influence now, or guidance, or participation, and I think that's a good way for an entrepreneur to think about things.
Makes a lot of sense. Jim, anything to add?
You know, I'm looking at this conversation from a totally different perspective, being that you know, I'm interested in small businesses and getting people off of the sofa. And I know a little bit about these two guys. Like, I think I know your cousin is Cecile, right?
Yes, it is.
Nailed it. So I've been following you for a while. I've seen your billboards and stuff, and so I know the companies. And what's interesting to me is that these guys have created really cool million-dollar businesses that I think a lot of people out there could do the same thing. These guys are doing one thing that they do really well. You know, Michael's done brand his entire life. Right, haven't you, pretty much?
I've been in the ad business a long, long time.
Yeah, and so, you know, for him to be an entrepreneur is an extension of what he studied in school. And I don't know if that's true for Dan, but I imagine you've been in tech for a really long time. And at some point you said, I can do this better than my boss, and I can go out and start something on my own. And it's not creative. Neither of these guys, I would say, are, from an entrepreneurial sense, creative. They are, however, though, very innovative. And that's a huge, huge difference. They didn't create the ad agency. Definition 6 is not the first person, and Dan's not the first one to say mobile. That's not new. But what they did is they proved my point that creativity is not important. Forget about it. Find something you can do really well, like build a brand or build a mobile, and then go do it better than the guy that was paying you 6 months ago. That's the way I was listening to the conversation.
Fantastic point and very well put. Guys, let's do this. Let's let people know how to get in touch with you, because I think some of our listeners, after hearing this today, are either going to want to make some mobile changes, they're going to want to reach their customers through stronger brand messaging, or they're definitely going to want to go get this book on School for Startups. So Jim, let's start with you. How do people get the book in their hands?
Well, the best place is Amazon. It's you know, just buy it there. It's also schoolforstartups.com. The cool thing is, if you buy the book for $11 on Amazon, it comes with a 80-hour learning center that's a soup to nuts entrepreneurship, how to get an idea if you don't have one, how to steal an idea without getting caught, how to raise money, how to do it for $5,000, 42 tricks to bootstrapping, all of the things that my co-author Chris Hanks, who's the head of entrepreneurship at UGA, everything we know about how to start a business. And you get that entire learning center for free if you buy the $11 book. So I think it's a real power of value. Also, I want to pitch internationalentrepreneurship.com, which is a free resource that we run for 110 countries around the world. If you want to go to Bolivia, that's the place to start. If you want to move into Pakistan, I would start there. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, Jim, we appreciate it. Michael, how do people find out about Definition 6?
You go to www.definition6thenumber.com, or you follow me on Twitter at mcogon, K-O-G-O-N.
Sounds great. All right, and we're going to look for some real interaction off that Twitter feed, right? Are you doing live tweets certain nights of the week, or...
I don't run those type of events. You'll get a lot of value if you start to follow us.
All right, good deal. Dan, how about you? How do we find out about SmartSoft Mobile Solutions?
SmartSoftMobile.com, SmartSoftMobile.com. And if you go to any of the app stores that are out there and search on SmartSoft, you'll be able to download some of our apps.
Great information. Guys, thank you so much for being on the show today. Very valuable information. I hope our listeners out there get in touch with you and take advantage of some of the stuff that you talked about today. As always, I'm your host, Andy Lowe. This has been Renegade Radio, brought to you by Renegade Concepts and the good folks here at Business Radio X. We hope you'll tune in with us each and every week as we explore the opportunities that are available out there to you. But remember, opportunity lies in the impossible, but you have to be willing to break the rules of conventional thinking. Until next time.